This is episode 5 of the podcast. If you haven't yet listened to episode 4, check that out. We'll meet you back here. Around 5 or 6 o'clock every evening, Salahuddin raced his brothers and sisters to the windows of their apartment.
My mother had 12 children. So everything was always a race. Race to the window, get the good spot, and that's where you stayed for the evening.
Their windows faced two social clubs with long green awnings. Each night, they watched the cars that pulled up to the curb and the people who got out.
The ladies always wore gloves and hats, and the men wore suits and neckties, and they were very fancy, and we thought they were all rich. That was our entertainment.
It was the 1950s, and Salah and his family lived in a neighborhood called the Hill District. Bob Jameson grew up not too far away from Salah. He remembers those same busy streets.
They used to have clubs and bars all up and down Center Avenue and Wiley Avenue. And man, some of the best entertainers in the world used to just loaf there. You know, Lena Horne, Earl Grant.
Bob says he and his sister were a dancing duo. They used to love to go for walks.
And my parents never knew this. We used to walk past bars and you'd hear the music and we would dance and people would say, come on in, and we would dance and they would give us money to dance, you know.
The Harlem poet Claude McKay called the Hill District the crossroads of the world. There were streets full of life, nightclubs, restaurants, hotels, people. When Bob Jameson told me about the Hill one day, he remembered the quote as crossroads of the universe. The people in the Hill didn't know it was all under threat. From 90.5 WESA, this is Land and Power. Who has it, what they do with it, and how that shapes the cities around us. I'm Margaret J. Krause. In the late 1940s and 1950s, Pittsburgh was in dire straits. There was polluted water, polluted air. People were leaving the city for the suburbs. At the time, the Hill District faced the same existential threat East Liberty did. Pittsburgh's urban renewal plans gutted both of them. But then, the neighborhood's fates diverged. Starting in the 1990s, East Liberty saw a lot of targeted investment, attention and resources from city agencies, and tax breaks for developers. Year after year, that money reshaped the neighborhood. It was a slow simmer that came to a boil in 2015 at Penn Plaza. That same kind of pressure is building in the Hill District right now. People already worry about what that will mean for long-term residents. But unlike in East Liberty, which changed block by block over the course of two decades, a full third of the Hill District is set for redevelopment. And one single entity has the rights to the land. Across the country, it often seems like a given that when a place changes, it pushes people out. But maybe it doesn't have to be that way. Today, even if the city's systems haven't changed that much, can the lessons of East Liberty help the Hill District and Pittsburgh chart a new path forward? Pittsburgh started on the flat land at the confluence of three rivers. As the city grew, it climbed a hill 2 miles to the east. The Hill District was the first stop for wave after wave of new arrivals. It was a mixed neighborhood in just about every sense. Businesses mingled with houses, there was every level of income, and it was diverse. People from all over built their lives there. But by the 1920s, the Hill was most famous for its thriving Black community. Reverend Regina Reagan Dykes remembers the Hill as the center of Black life in the city.
We claimed it, we owned it, we built it. You know, Blacks, because we had the Hill, they didn't mess with us because we were a unit.
The neighborhood was also an entertainment destination. The clubs and bars that clustered closer to downtown, in the Lower Hill, were on the flight path of jazz legends. Brenda Tate grew up a few blocks away in the Middle Hill. She still lives on the same street. On a perfect fall afternoon, we met there for a walk through the past.
Hi. Hello, how are you?
How are you?
Brenda remembers what the Hill District used to sound like. She says there was always noise, good noise.
People made their own garages and fixed cars, and there were small bars, laughter, Music, always music in the community.
Brenda, Regina, Bob, and Sala, they lived in a city still recovering from the burdens of the Great Depression. It hit the Hill District hard. Black workers were often the first to be laid off, and federal aid programs provided less money to black families than to white. On August 26, 1937, a man named W.S. Clemens gave federal mortgage agents a rundown of Pittsburgh's neighborhoods. In East Liberty, Clemens described poor structures and a lower-class populace. In the Hill District, he reported, quote, undesirables, lots of black and Jewish people. Both neighborhoods were graded D, hazardous, and colored red on the map. It was another blow to these two neighborhoods. Redlining encoded and enforced segregation in cities across the country. Social psychiatrist Dr. Mindy Fullilove says it sucked the wealth out of neighborhoods.
If you say, here's a neighborhood that's got old housing and the people are poorer, and you say, therefore, let's give them less help, the outcome is that those neighborhoods and those people have more trouble.
In 1955, Pittsburgh City Council approved an urban renewal plan that condemned 100 acres in the Lower Hill. Unlike in East Liberty, the city did not hold community meetings. For decades, the Hill District had called on the city to invest in the neighborhood, to build good roads and parks for children. Salah Uddin says the urban renewal plan promised just that.
A new neighborhood, a new community. We automatically assumed it was for us.
That year, city agents fanned out over the Lower Hill to make building assessments. Photos show men in suits holding up big signs with parcel numbers, P955, P328. I spent a long time looking at the other people in these photos. The man on the barbershop steps, glancing over his shoulder. Kids in striped t-shirts playing in front of the candy store. I wondered if they knew. Their streets were for sale. A few years later, when Brenda was in the third grade, she noticed something was off with the grown-ups.
There was a certain buzz that was very different than the day-to-day.
Brenda went to Lecce Elementary School. It was on the edge of the Lower Hill. Most days she walked home for lunch, but sometimes she stayed to eat with one of her best friends, Jackie Stackhouse.
She never said she was moving. She never said she was leaving. And it was just one day, or 1 week, I didn't see her. I said, well, maybe she's sick. And then she never came back.
Then the wrecking balls came. Crews tore down the Lowendai Club and the Crawford Grill, Molina Ravioli Bar and Johnson's Coffee Shop, Hayes Drugstore and the Webster Avenue Barbershop. House after house after house after house. They tore down Bethel AME Church, home to the oldest black congregation west of the Allegheny Mountains and a stop on the Underground Railroad. In their place, the city planned to build a new cultural district.
They had no regard for us as human beings.
Some people moved to other parts of the neighborhood, but many just moved away. The destruction of the Lower Hill marched up Center Avenue and into the Middle and Upper Hill. A new highway severed the hill from downtown. Businesses struggled. The city's promise of a brand new neighborhood turned out to be empty. They did build parking lots and a large auditorium called the Civic Arena. But by the 1960s, the Lower Hill became shorthand for what not to do.
It was a whole intact life, and it was so connected that when they lost that, it was like losing a part of their body.
After the assassination of Martin Luther King Jr., riots were another blow to the Hill District. Businesses were firebombed and windows were smashed. The upheaval led more people to leave. Then, in the 1980s, the city's economy collapsed. Pittsburgh has changed a lot since then. On another perfect fall day, I walked up Center Avenue in the Hill District. It was lunchtime. I passed people out walking dogs and running errands at the shopping plaza. The Hill has one of the lowest vacancy rates in the city. People want to be there. But more than a quarter of the land is vacant. A third of residents live in poverty. In 2019, the shopping plaza's long-awaited grocery store closed after just 6 years in business. I was on my way to talk with Marimba Malliance.
Hello, how's it going? Good, you?
Good, good to see you.
It's so nice to see anyone in person.
I know.
She runs the neighborhood's community development corporation, the Hill CDC. Marimba comes from a family of community activists. Her parents participated in the civil rights movement. Later, her dad, Jake Malliance, represented the Hill District on city council. Marimba thinks a lot about what families and businesses lost on the Lower Hill, particularly Black families and businesses.
How do you measure that cost? How do you measure that cost? It is emotional, it is spiritual, and it's generational. And so when we talk about equitable development, it's not an equation that can be put on paper.
But the Hill District has to try to quantify that loss. Because while the city and county own the land, they've promised its future to one large private entity.
Private hockey with your Pittsburgh Penguins.
The future of the Lower Hill rests with a National Hockey League team, the Pittsburgh Penguins. Back in 2007, the Pittsburgh Penguins played their 40th season at the Civic Arena. A lot of people loved the igloo, as the fans called it, but it wasn't in the best shape. In the late 90s, the city and county helped to finance new stadiums for the Steelers and the Pirates. The Penguins, which are co-owned by hockey legend Mario Lemieux, wanted a new arena. They said if they didn't get one, they had no choice but to leave Pittsburgh.
My name is Yaron Zober.
In 2006, Yaron Zober was chief of staff to Pittsburgh's mayor, so finding a way to keep the Penguins fell to him. He and Mayor Luke Ravenstahl believe the Penguins were critical to the city's existence.
It's something that makes the city special, brings the city together, has its own economic development effect, but actually kind of puts it on the map. You know, Pittsburgh is a major league town because it has major league sports.
Yaron worked with the county to try to find a way to build the arena. He worked with the state, too. They planned to pony up a lot of money. It was going pretty well. There was a basic deal. But then there was this meeting. Late night, downtown Pittsburgh. Everyone was there but the governor, Ed Rendell. 20 minutes late, he walked in. And Yaron says he almost immediately picked a fight with the Penguins' lawyer.
He was calling him names, calling him a liar, had nothing to do with the negotiations at that table.
Not only that, the governor arrived with the last person the Penguins wanted to see. This is a little complicated, but it's important. Pennsylvania had decided to legalize casinos, and they were only going to give out a few licenses. The Penguins wanted to build a casino along with their new arena, but the state chose someone else, a guy named Don Barden. And now, here he was, in the room. He promised to help fund the arena, but his presence irked the Penguins. It was tense. Someone, Yaron doesn't remember who, tried to bring the meeting back to the arena. So, $300 million arena, gonna need a bond. How about we... The Penguins interrupted.
Excuse us, we have to leave the room.
Co-owners Mario Lemieux and Ron Burkle walked out. The others waited. After a few minutes, the room's big wooden doors swung open.
They say, "Thank you, gentlemen. We don't want to waste any more of your time. We have appointments to make in Las Vegas and Kansas City."
Let's take a short break. We'll be right back.
Americans are grappling with a huge question right now. Can we trust the cops?
These are the different reasons people were put on the list. Falsifying reports or records.
What if I told you that in states all across the country,
issuance of unlawful orders,
there are lists that could tell you if individual cops were trustworthy.
Obedience to laws and policies.
These lists can draw a straight line from an officer's name to past misconduct. The problem is, there's a good chance you're not allowed to see them.
To turn a blind eye is basically saying, well, I hope the justice system works. That's not good enough for me.
I'm Jason Moon. From New Hampshire Public Radio, Document, Season 1, The List, a podcast about one state's decades of secrecy around police misconduct. Binge all the episodes now, wherever you get your podcasts.
The Pittsburgh Penguins seemed pretty serious about leaving the city. Mayoral Chief of Staff Yaron Zober spent a few frantic weeks trying to salvage the deal. He finally managed to talk them back to the table.
If we pledge this much, here's what the bond issue could be, et cetera, et cetera. It's just math. But the pot was still not sweet enough. So during this meeting, I think it was the governor's way of kind of saying, hey, city and county, what are you putting in this mix?
Yaron knew they had to make this deal work fast. The clock was ticking. What did they put in the mix? Exclusive development rights to the Lower Hill District.
Do you remember what you thought when you heard that this thing had been inked?
Sorrow. Powerlessness. Betrayal.
Salahuddin had represented the Hill District on city council until just a couple years before the deal with the Penguins was made. He never saw it coming. The deal wasn't terribly unusual. Cities from Oakland, California to Seattle, Washington have shelled out millions of dollars in public money to keep their sports teams happy. Land is often part of the mix. But no one from the Hill District had been consulted before the Lower Hill was used as a bargaining chip. It still doesn't make sense to Marimba Malayans. A couple days after we talked in her office, we met up on the Lower Hill.
I'll never quite understand how you can have 28 acres in the heart of your city and not have any public engagement process, not have any public bid process. I will never understand that. But that's where we landed.
The Hill District deal, like the Penn Plaza deal, met with almost immediate disapproval from the community. Not because the promises missed the mark, but because there were no promises. That was 13 years ago. Today, there's a new arena, but the rest of the Lower Hill is mostly parking lots. It bothers a lot of people that the land just sits there and the Penguins collect parking money. It wasn't supposed to still be like this. There were delays and deals fell through. But that actually allowed the Lower Hill District to press the Penguins for commitments on things like affordable housing, home ownership, jobs, and cultural initiatives. Daniel Lavelle is now the neighborhood's city councilor. At a redevelopment meeting last fall, he summed up the whole saga. In 2007, the Hill District got a raw deal, flat out, and they've been working to fix it ever since.
This was an effort to sort of say, we know you screwed us, but again, we're going to try to layer some good on top of it, and we're going to keep rolling this ball downhill until we've extracted every possible benefit and everything that's worthwhile for this community.
On the Penguin side, there's one guy tasked with making sure the Lower Hill development satisfies both the team and the Hill District.
Kevin Acklin, Chief Operating Officer of the Pittsburgh Penguins.
Yep, Kevin Acklin, the mayor's right-hand man who negotiated Penn Plaza. When he was still with the city, Kevin helped rewrite the Penguins deal. The team made real, tangible promises to the public. He resigned from city government in 2017 and joined the Penguins in 2018. He likes to say he has a different job now, but his work on the Lower Hill is the same.
The Lower Hill development is an opportunity, a huge opportunity, to correct past wrongs.
The organization that Marimba leads, the Hill CDC, has a lot of ideas about how the Penguins can do that. And they're officially at the table in a way they weren't before, thanks to a 2018 law. The city now requires developers to talk with communities early in the planning process. To do that, they coordinate with what's called a registered community organization. In the Hill District, that group is the Hill CDC. Now, the Penguins have proposed three different projects in the Lower Hill. For each one, they held a public meeting. They also agreed to participate in a review process created by the Hill CDC.
All right, everybody. Just want to welcome you to the Hill CDC's Hill District Community Meeting. Okay, I'm going to turn this over to Felicity, who's going to...
During a Zoom meeting in September, Felicity Williams reminded people about that process.
Felicity?
Thank you, Marimba. I just wanted to address...
Felicity is the Hill CDC's policy and programs manager. She said projects must score an 80 or above.
In the Hill District, C's do not get degrees. You have to have a B in order to pass in the Hill District because we want to see high-quality development and we want to see sufficient alignment with the community's vision on each development project.
One of the Penguins' projects passed muster, but two did not. Felicity said since then, the Penguins have disengaged from the community process. When I asked to talk with Kevin Acklin about the Hill CDC's assertions, he emailed to say the Penguins had dozens of meetings and, quote, remain fully committed to the community engagement process. His email echoed a conversation we had back in September.
The goal here is to do the right thing and to build and to collaborate and to produce a development that everybody feels welcome and that the community feels empowered by and that supports projects in the Middle and Upper Hill.
Marimba Malayans worries the community and the Penguins still have a very different understanding of what that looks like. Marimba says she'd rather not function on promises. Instead, she wants the city to require things. That's public stewardship.
If we're going to really embrace equity in this region, it is going to take a pretty seismic shift in the way that we are thinking.
In 2019, the city's Gender Equity Commission released a paper. It said Pittsburgh is a very livable city for white residents, less livable for black men, and most unlivable for black women. The report went on to say that if a black woman in Pittsburgh moved to nearly any other city in the United States, she'd see an almost immediate increase in health, employment, and education outcomes. The day we met on the Lower Hill to talk, Marimba looked out over the empty lots and said if Pittsburgh really wants to grow, it can't afford to be unlivable. It has to keep the people it's got, then attract more.
You've got to figure out a way to signal that this is a city of the future, meaning it's a city where we envision you here. We're diverse, we appreciate people of color, we appreciate our black community.
If the city can't get it right on the Lower Hill, Marimba doesn't know how they'll do it, how they'll demonstrate that Pittsburgh is really a city for all.
Like, this is it. If you get it wrong again, you've messed up another generation.
Last spring, the city's redevelopment agency delayed a critical vote on one of the Penguins' proposals. They wanted details on what the community could expect. But Mayor Bill Peduto urged them to move forward, and they did. They voted yes a week later, despite the Hill CDC's objections. When asked if that undermined the city's commitment to community process, the mayor said no.
What I've asked the Penguins to do is to voluntarily work with the community and see what more they can give.
His response reminded me of Penn Plaza. Basically everything that happened there, working with the city, the relocation benefit, the money for affordable housing, it was all voluntary. A lot of people didn't like the deal, but by that point the city had no leverage to ask for anything different. That's the thing about a volunteer. They're doing you a favor. They don't have to. Penn Plaza demonstrated that showing up and demanding more from the city and developers can be effective. Gains can be made. But nothing is guaranteed. And it's a lot of work. In the case of Penn Plaza, activists and advocates and even city staff decided the solution was policy change, to create rules so a community can affect development and benefit from it. In the Lower Hill, those rules already exist. And yet exactly how the rules should be followed remains open to interpretation. The Penguins' plans will go through the normal city process, but that process was built for people whose job is to navigate it. Most development meetings are held midday downtown, and they last for hours. If you're worried about a development, it can be pretty difficult to be heard. But even if you are heard, it's not clear that anyone has to address your concerns or change their plans. Former city councilor Salah Uddin says this is the persistent problem. We always start in the wrong place.
You first have to answer the initial questions of what's priority and who's in the conversation. What are the goals?
I thought about Salah's questions on my way to an interview this fall in a part of Pittsburgh called Homewood. The same forces in the Hill District and in East Liberty, decades of disinvestment, cheap land, and a growing appetite for development, they're at work in neighborhoods across the city. I wanted to go to Homewood because people told me how worried they are that it's next. It's close to East Liberty, it's flat, and it's on a major bus line. I went to talk with Reverend Regina Reagan Dykes. She grew up in the Lower Hill and is now a pastor at a church called New Life. We sat in the front room with the door open to the street. She said she's pretty sure about Homewood's fate.
Oh, it's going to flip. Because now you see, before you didn't see whites, and now they're buying the property cheap.
She's just seen it too many times to think otherwise. Regina saw what happened in the Lower Hill District, and then she lived most of her adult life in East Liberty.
You can't afford to live in East Liberty now. Oh, they built it up, but who can afford to live in it? You know, the wages haven't changed.
She says the city has to find ways to invest in people and systems that support people, especially at the grassroots level. She says the city needs to start by listening.
You can't make a neighborhood what you want it to be. You got to see what the neighborhood wants and build that way.
Homewood spent the last few years trying to do just that. Block by block, residents met to talk about what their priorities are, what their goals are. The neighborhood's community organization got the city to adopt the 199-page plan that came out of that. The plan helps keep the community's aims at the table without them having to pack a hearing room. It's a level of protection the city's trying to create for all neighborhoods. And it's launched an initiative called Forging PGH to take a close look at how Pittsburgh uses land and how that could be different. But something Sala Udin said kept gnawing at me. That if you start to pick away at development, you find it's all tangled up with race and class and broken promises.
That's a very difficult conversation.
So instead of talking about that, we talk about where the building will go and who will build it.
So that's why it takes so long to make progress. And you look back over your shoulder at the last 25 years or 50 years and ask yourself, how far have we come? Not very far.
Sala was talking about the Lower Hill and the half century he spent waiting for and trying to make something good happen there. But it was hard not to think about the history of our country. While I was reporting this story, George Floyd died under the knee of a Minneapolis police officer. It forced many Americans to look around and ask, how did we get here? How can it be different?
You must pay close attention. You must keep your eye on the prize.
This summer, protests across the country decried police brutality. And then the protests expanded. Police brutality is part of a much wider web of systemic problems. On a Monday afternoon in July, hundreds of people marched through East Liberty. They came to protest a proposal that would bring a police station back to the neighborhood. Protesters held signs that said, "Stop over-policing black communities," and "Fund communities, not cops."
This isn't a cute march. We're here to get done. Pittsburgh needs to make changes.
Organizers said police enforced gentrification. The bringing police back to East Liberty was just an opportunity to kick people of color out of the neighborhood. A number of people I spoke with later said they're eager to have the police come back. It was planned out 2 years ago. But the fight over Penn Plaza made East Liberty a rallying point, a potent symbol of how development can undermine people with long histories in communities. It was a connection I heard people make over and over. A few days earlier, I had called Bob Jamison. I asked what he thought, if there's a link between police brutality and gentrification. He laughed, without a doubt.
Like I say, if you study history, it's the exact same thing. Ain't that what they did to the Indians? We want to take the land. We want to build on the land. How do we do that? Bring in the cavalry. The reason why police brutality function at a level that it does now is because they have a military attitude towards minorities. They're the enemy.
In one of our early conversations, Bob said part of why he got burned out with Penn Plaza was disappointment. A lot of people fighting for housing didn't seem fired up about voting or politics. They didn't see what he saw. It's all part of the same big struggle.
The average person, they're not paying attention.
Bob lives right on the border with East Liberty. And every time protesters gathered in the neighborhood this summer, they went past his house. One day, he went downstairs to check out the crowd. What he saw was a lot of people waking up, choosing to stand for something. When we stood at the old Penn Plaza site last winter, Bob had said that's just about the only thing that matters.
The true measure of a man or a woman is, did you do anything to help make this a better place, a better country, a better community? You know, you have to contribute something.
Like he told me a year ago, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Bob is wading back into housing issues again. He knows it can take a long time for things to change. But the only option is to start moving. And then, keep going. Land and Power is a production of 90.5 WESA, reported and hosted by me, Margaret J. Krause. The show was edited and produced by Liz Reed. Production help from Katie Blackley, Kylie Kaczynski, and Sarah Kovach. Fact-checking by Sonu Babu, Patrick Doyle, Mary Rose O'Donnell, Isabel Schmeller, and Naomi Starobin. Special thanks to NPR's Story Lab team, including Uri Berliner, Nigeri Eden, Adelina Lansianese, Michael May, and Yowei Shaw. Thanks also goes to Juanita Arterberry, Mark Belko, David Boylan, Edward Burton, and Kate Giamarisi. Brian Izette, Ashley Johnson, John Miller, Larkin Page Jacobs, Lucy Perkins, Chris Potter, and Ralph Proctor. Britt Radomski, Carl Redwood, Glenn Ritchie, and Ellis Robinson. Celeste Scott, Luther and Roxanne Sewell, Dale Snyder, and Mary Lee Williams. We've got photos of Regina, Sala, Brenda, Marimba, the Lower Hill, and more at landandpowerpod.com.